Okay, I just want to observe this same split between saving and investment, this idea that saving disappears into hoards and investment comes out of nowhere. The same approach is applied to the treatment of taxes and government spending. How are taxes typically viewed in terms of their effect on overall economic activity? If taxes go up or down, what is supposed to be the effect on overall economic activity? It's an inverse relation that greater taxes, they're treated essentially in the same way as saving. That it's presumed that the taxes just disappear. They're a leakage too. They're described as a leakage in the contemporary text. And government spending is treated as another exogenous variable, something that's very positive. Now, in reality, taxes and government spending are inseparably connected. When there are more taxes, there will be more government spending. The government is not going to sit on the taxes, you can be sure. And when there is more government spending, unless the printing press is at work, there will have to be more taxes. So government spending in and of itself is not expansionary. To the extent that it would come out of taxes, there's simply a change in the direction of spending. The taxpayers have less money, they spend less. The government has more, it spends more. The direction of spending is changed, but not the overall amount. The only thing that creates a connection to the overall amount is if and to the extent that the government finances its spending by the creation of new and additional money. But then the essential thing to be identified is the expansion of the money supply, not government spending.
What about deficit spending?
Well, even deficit spending is inflationary only to the extent that the deficit is financed by the creation of money. If the government financed its deficit by borrowing from the public, there wouldn't be any overall expansion. There'd be less funds available to lend to businesses and in the mortgage market. The government would have more money. The private economy would have less. And as a matter of fact, in the long run, if you had deficit financing without the ability to create money, it would end up being deflationary. Why would that be the case? Well, what would be the effect of the government having an ever-growing debt? Well, where would that end if they didn't have the ability to create money?
The taxpayer would have to pay it. They'd have less money to spend. Prices would end up.
Well, if the taxpayer is paying, then the deficit is overcome. I'm asking, what would be the effect if you have a government that could not create money and was nevertheless then they would go bankrupt. Then they'd go bankrupt. Now, that happened to Orange County. It wouldn't have happened if Orange County had had the ability to create money. Then they could just have created money. But they didn't have that ability, and they ended up going into bankruptcy. Now, if the federal government ever went into bankruptcy, just think why that would be deflationary. What connection do government bonds have with the assets of the banking system? Aren't government securities a major asset of the banking system? Well, if the government ever went bankrupt, what would be the effect on the asset value of the banks? They would be badly undercut, and then you'd end up having bank runs, and that would produce an actual decrease in the quantity of money. Now, that is not going to happen under our present system, but it doesn't happen only because the government has the ability to create more and more money. You and I wouldn't go bankrupt either, even if we maxed out all our credit cards and continued beyond that, if we had the ability that the government has to create money. If when the credit card companies were dunning you, if you could manufacture the payments due, you wouldn't go bankrupt either. The government doesn't go bankrupt because it has the ability to create money, so long as the money it owes is the money it's able to create. Now, I make a point here, C, The idea...
We're not seeing it up there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for calling that to my attention. Forgive me. There we go. I have to reduce it to make it fit. Okay, the idea that saving is hoarding, point C, represents the fallacy of composition. That fallacy is assuming that what is true of the case of an individual can be expanded to the system as a whole, that what's true of a given individual will apply to the system in which the individual participates. Let me make that clear in the following way. Imagine that this class represented a self-contained economic system. Suppose we locked the door for half an hour and we went through some kind of procedure where each of you would produce something and other members of the class would buy it. We'd have some kind of imitation of economic activity. Now, to the extent that the class as a whole engaged in saving, it would not be possible for the class as a whole to save in the form of adding to its cash holding. Now, let's just see why not. As of this moment, each of us has some amount of cash in his pocket or purse or wherever, and it will add up to some definite total. Let's imagine that in the class as a whole, as of this moment, there's $1,000 of cash or whatever. Now, whatever buying and selling we engage in among ourselves, some individuals, when we conclude the process, some individuals could have saved in the form of adding to their cash holdings. So suppose we have student A. He starts the process with $50 of cash in his pocket, and when we put a stop to the activity, he has $95. And so he has saved $45, which he's added to his cash holding. So that can certainly happen with a given individual, but what's implied about the cash holdings of the rest of the class all combined? That has to be reduced by 45 because there's no more cash than there was to begin with. So while individuals can save by adding to their cash holdings, their added cash holdings represent reductions in cash holdings on the part of others. So there can be no overall aggregate net saving in the form of the addition of cash, with one limited exception, and that would be the extent to which there's an increase in the quantity of money. If somehow we had an arrangement whereby, as we're doing what we're doing, the quantity of money in the class could be increased from $1,000 to $1,100, well, then you could have the $100 added to cash holdings. But that would be the maximum. Apart from that, all saving that occurs beyond the increase in the quantity of money, that has to have a counterpart in the increase in the value of assets other than cash. It has to show up, in effect, in investment. Yes, Mr. Rosen.
I was going to say, what happens if one of the students acts as a bank and starts to lend money or create checking deposits?
Okay, well, then we have the case that we have an increase in the quantity of money, and that addition to the quantity of money, that could be added to cash holdings. But that would be the extent of it. Now, pardon me?
But the door is closed.
Yeah.
No, but the door is closed.
A literal or figurative door.
The door is closed, so if a student were to have developed some type of banking system, it really wouldn't matter because no money is coming from outside.
Yeah, but in this case, there'd be new and additional money created within the class.
So $100.
Whatever the amount. If we assume 100, then accumulated savings in the form of cash would rise by 100. But to whatever extent the magnitude of aggregate saving exceeds the increase in the quantity of money, the only way it can do so is to the extent there is an increase in the value of assets other than cash. So if we were to say, well, in our hypothetical classroom economy, we have 500 of aggregate saving. If there were no increase in the quantity of money, the only way we could have this 500 of saving would be if there were an increase in the value of assets of 500. To the extent we have 100 of additional money, then the value of other assets has to go up by 400. The aggregate saving has to have a counterpart in net investment. Aggregate net saving has to have an equivalent in net investment except for the increase in the quantity of money itself. Okay, now let me go further here, and this is point D, that genuine hoarding, understood as an increase in the need and desire to hold cash, such hoarding has nothing to do with saving. It's nothing to do with saving. What it represents is really an attempt to change the composition of existing savings, to change them from assets other than cash into cash. When we have, when people truly attempt to hoard, to increase their cash holdings, I suppose people start to fear that a credit crunch is coming. Business firms start fearing a credit crunch is coming. And they're overextended. They've borrowed very heavily. They have debts coming due. Their cash position is weak. What do they need to do to deal with this problem?
Sell
assets to do what?
Raise cash.
To raise cash. They need to change the composition of their assets. Let's say here we are, we have a hypothetical company. Its capital is $10 million, and out of this $10 million, they have a very modest amount of cash. Let's say they have $100,000 in cash. That's 1% of their assets. And they have current liabilities looming. They have various other assets, of course. And if they're afraid of being caught in an illiquid position, they have to now raise cash. Different firms can attempt different procedures. Some might have an inventory clearance. Sell out your inventory and add the receipts or much of the receipts to your cash holding. If you have accounts receivable coming due, collect them and don't re-extend as many. Or if you have more than one store, maybe you need to sell one of the stores. Or if you have different divisions, maybe you need to liquidate something. You have to take steps to raise cash. Now, when firms do this, what would be the appropriate description of what they're doing? Would it be A, they're engaged in saving. B, they're engaged in changing the composition of their accumulated savings. It's changing the composition of their accumulated savings. When firms are seeking to acquire cash, that does not represent saving. It represents an attempt to change the makeup of their already accumulated savings. And it's this activity which precipitates a recession. In the course of the boom, firms get into an illiquid position. They're investing every last dollar of cash for various reasons, which we've actually looked at. If they've had the expectation that they'll be able to borrow easily and profitably, well, that reduces their perceived need to hold cash. If they think the demand for their products will be rising, that appears to make it easy to liquidate inventories at a profit. So these are reasons why firms would tend to become less liquid, have less cash relative to their overall activities. But then what happens if credit ceases to be so easily obtainable? Suppose they start to worry they may not be able to refinance some of the loans they have outstanding, and they may not be able to liquidate their inventory at a profit. Then what do they have to do?
Change their savings.
They have to change the composition of their savings. Not save, they already have savings. They have to reduce the fraction of the savings they have that are invested in things like inventory, and they have to increase the fraction that's invested in cash. And when such behavior becomes widespread and substantial, the actual effect is, in the economy as a whole, to reduce the overall amount of saving. When you have a tendency toward greater cash holdings, well, first of all, what's going to be the effect on sales revenues? What's going to be the effect on spending and sales revenues? That will fall. And what's the effect of that on profits? That falls. And as profits fall, what's the effect on funds added to retained earnings?
That falls.
That falls, which means saving is cut. And if firms are incurring losses, or the profits that they're earning are inadequate to cover the dividends that they're paying, what's that do to their already accumulated capitals? It reduces it. So their accumulated saving is reduced. And to the extent that people lose their jobs in the process, what is the effect on their accumulated savings?
Goes down.
They'll be drawing on them. Their saving will be negative. So hoarding, the effect of a greater demand for money for holding, it's so far from being the same as saving that it actually operates to reduce saving or turn it negative. You had a question, Mr. Chung?
Yeah, so would you consider a firm is saving when they, you know, restructure and downsize during the economic slowdown?
No, I'm not saying that that's saving at all. I'm saying that that's something very different, that they're engaged in changing the composition of their savings. When a firm sells a branch in order to raise cash, that's not an active saving. They're attempting to change the way their assets are held. Instead of holding as much of their assets in the form of a physical branch, they want to hold more of their assets in the form of cash. It's not that they're engaged in saving.
But your cash account will increase, right? So that would consider saving.
No. Let's look at it this way. Let's look at it from the point of view of an individual investor. Suppose we have an individual investor with a net worth of $1 million. And when we look at him, he's invested $975,000 in common stocks and $25,000 in cash. And he becomes alarmed at this. He thinks maybe the market is going to go down. So he sells a couple of $100,000 worth of stocks and decides to hold the proceeds for a time till he knows better. Well, let's assume he can get out at the same prices. So now, instead of having 975 in stocks and 25 in cash, he's got 225 in cash and 775 in stocks. Has he engaged in saving, or has he simply changed the composition of his already existing $1 million of saving? He's changed the composition, and as a matter of fact, if this behavior is widespread and people are suddenly deciding they need to increase their liquidity, what do you think will happen to the value of the stocks?
Go down.
It'll go down. So he might have had a million initially, but if large numbers of investors are attempting to increase the fraction of their net worth in cash, the overall total of their net worth is going to go down. Their accumulated savings will be less. So this is very different than hoarding. Hoarding and saving are so far different that when there is, in fact, the attempt to hoard, the accumulated savings will drop. Yes, Mr. Castillo.
If they took the difference, their interest rate that they made, or the positive cash flow they made on a certain stock, and they changed that into cash, that wouldn't necessarily be hoarding or changing the composition. That would be truly making money.
You're saying, suppose they decide to hold more of the dividends coming in the form of cash?
Correct.
Well, they might do that, and then you could say, all right, here's an individual, he has an income, and he's deciding to hold his income in the form of cash.
Right.
Okay, now, he's earning the income, he's not consuming it. So we could say, all right, he's saving. That's true. He's saving, and he's attempting to add his saving to cash. And so sometimes individuals do that. But what precipitates a recession is not that the individuals are simply holding their income more in cash. They're attempting to change the composition of their existing assets. And that will have the effect of reducing incomes if they're attempting to increase the fraction in cash holdings. Now, what is also true is that once the process gets going, people can start to be frightened about their jobs. And then there are people who don't have any significant savings, and they're worried now all of a sudden about losing their jobs, and they decide, well, boy, we need to get some savings to be protected. And so they might step up their saving to safeguard against losing their job. And it's possible that if all the conventional forms of investment look bad, maybe they'll attempt to hold their savings in the form of cash, because the normal avenues of profitable investment have been taken away. But that's a derivative phenomenon. The thing that launches it is that business firms find that they're insufficiently liquid. They need to boost their cash holdings relative to their overall assets and current liabilities. Yes, Mr. Rosenthal.
Going back to something you said before the break, that the increase in home values that we've seen in this area is due to credit expansion.
Yeah, I think the nationwide increase, to the extent that it's occurred not just here, but in many other places, credit expansion brought down interest rates very sharply, and this made possible borrowing much more substantial sums at relatively low monthly payments, and this has served to boost house prices. Now, what will happen if the credit expansion stops and interest rates rise significantly? Suppose mortgage rates get back to 7% or something like that. Now, what will that do when there are new people coming around ready to buy a house and they'll have to pay 7% instead of, what is it right now?
5.5.
Okay, that makes a significant difference in your monthly payments. So, how many new buyers will be able to afford the high prices that many of the existing owners have paid?
Well, fewer.
I'd say much fewer. And so if the existing owners want to sell, in what conditions will they have to sell? On what terms?
It'll
have to be at a sharply lower price.
So do you believe this will occur?
Well, I can't say to a certainty that it will occur. I'm confident that at some point interest rates will be significantly higher, but whether it will be next month or next year, I don't know. Yes, Mr.
I was just going to mention, also people that were able to buy houses now because of lower interest rates that bought houses on adjustable or variable loans, when these interest rates go up, they budgeted for lower interest rates, but now that interest rates will rise, that's when houses will probably be offered back onto the market at low rates because people won't be able to afford what they're in.
Right. That's a further point that I don't know what proportion of mortgages are variable rate right now. Does anyone know?
On the left.
Yeah.
I mean, the fixed rates are so low. The fixed rates are very low.
So 4.25.
4.25, quarter versus 5.5.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how many people are taking the advantage of the 4.25.
But the further challenge in Orange County, in particular,
yeah.
Orange County and Florida,
yeah.
And Orange County and Florida and Nevada, or Las Vegas, Nevada, mm-hmm. is an instance where the property values are going up so rapidly. But the counter issue is that not only are people having adjustable rate mortgages, but they're getting interest only mortgages. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is that the sharp rise that will occur, not just in the normal step up of an adjustment of half a percent or a percent, but the sharp rise that will occur is going to equate to payment shock and a substantial amount of the fear is a substantial amount of defaults will occur. So even though 4.25 is the current adjustable rate, the payment options are much lower than the adjustable rate down to where it's at 2%, but there's negative amortization.
Okay, so if someone is paying 4.25 and then it goes to 7, that's like a 75% increase, almost. Yeah.
And equity loans also.
Yes, Mr. Davis.
Do you attribute any of the current thinking that the generation today has regarding credit and the use of credit to the practices of large banks? For instance, I consider myself back years ago, I think, Citibank sent me my first credit card in the mail at 18, right on my 18th birthday. I opened the mail one day, and I couldn't believe it was real. I actually went to the store, I think the next day, and charged $1,000. I couldn't believe they actually sent me a credit card. And sure enough, you know, I think that was a start for me to recognize what credit is and the power of credit and the whole thing. They didn't waste a day by having a credit card in my hand.
Well, you see, the ability to do that rests on their ability to create new and additional money. If they couldn't create new and additional money, the only funds available would have to be provided by savings.
And you're speaking of the aggregate, though, because the Citibank Corporation does not have the ability to create new and additional money.
The bank does, yeah. All under fractional reserve banking, all of the banks, to the extent they have any excess reserves, they can create new and additional deposits. And credit cards are lines of credit, and the ability to have a widespread extension of lines of credit, I think, depends on the ability to create new and additional money, a sudden widespread increase in lines of credit. And they wouldn't be in a position to do that if they didn't have this ability.
What was the percentage rate on that, Jay?
Okay, well, let me just say further that what sets things up where firms will suddenly need to become more liquid is that before that, they've been led to become unduly illiquid. First, in the boom phase, firms become unduly illiquid. They think that they'll be able to borrow easily and profitably. Everything they're doing is profitable. So they run their cash holdings down. They think they'll be able to liquidate their inventories easily and profitably. And when the music stops, or they start to fear that it's about to stop, then they have to rebuild their cash holdings. Yeah. Now, we would not have the need, we wouldn't get into this situation where firms suddenly need to become more liquid if they first had not become unduly illiquid. It's the process of becoming unduly illiquid in the preceding boom that is laying the groundwork for the later contraction.
Can you elaborate on that one?
Yeah. So long as firms think they can borrow easily and profitably on the foundation of credit expansion, the banking system is creating new and additional money that it's making available for loans.
Okay.
That holds interest rates down relative to the rate of profit. That makes it appear worthwhile to borrow. Debt burdens rise relative to assets.
Right.
It seems profitable. It's better to be leveraged. And it appears that you can liquidate your inventories more easily. So put more money into inventory rather than holding cash. It's this boom phase that is leading to the rundown in cash holdings, where firms are operating with less cash relative to their overall level of activity. The overall level of activity is jumped up by this phenomenon. But then, when the process comes to an end, people find they have inadequate cash balances. They now need to restore them. They weren't led into being illiquid in the first place, if we didn't have the boom, we would not have the basis for the bust. The boom is the basis of the bust. That's what I'm saying. All right, let's turn now to this proposition that what is saved is spent and actually accounts for most spending in the economic system. Saving is what accounts for most spending in the economic system. And let's start with one important, but by no means the most important example, expensive consumers' goods, of which the leading example is houses. How many people are in a position to buy a house out of current income? Yes?
Without a loan?
Cash?
Without a loan?
Yeah.
Without a loan?
Without a loan.
Cash.
Out of current income. Not just out of cash, but out of current income. So if you look at your annual income, let's say you're making $100,000 a year, how many people can afford to buy a $300,000, $400,000, or $500,000 house out of their annual income?
They wouldn't be in this class if they had that kind of flow.
Virtually nobody. Maybe Gates is happy with a $500 million mansion. I don't know what he spent for it, and he might have an annual income that's substantially greater than that. But leaving aside a bare handful of such exceptions, virtually nobody can afford to buy such a thing as a house out of a current year's income. How many people can afford to buy a new car out of their current income? You'll find more possibilities there. But even so, imagine that you're earning $100,000 a year. I think you'd probably be pressed a little bit to buy a $25,000 car out of that year's income, because you need your income for many other things. Now, most people are paid monthly or every 2 weeks, and in many cases, every week. How many people can buy even a toaster oven out of 1 week's income? Well, there are a lot of people perhaps who can do that, but can everybody? Pardon me?
Relatively small
toaster. That's it. What are toaster ovens going for today?
$40.
$40. Okay. Now, suppose someone, obviously, if you're making a good salary, you won't notice just $40. So you could do it. But there are many people who can't do this. And now, even if you're making a good salary, let's say you're paid once a month. Can you afford a new refrigerator out of the income of that 1 month?
It would be
a question. Let's say, what does a new refrigerator cost?
$1,500.
How much?
$1,500.
A good size refrigerator might cost close to $2,000. Okay, now let's suppose that your monthly income is $10,000. If you're paying taxes out of that, it's going to be an awful lot less. So suppose you're ending up with $6,000. Well, if your disposable funds are $6,000, I don't think you can just toss off a $2,000 expenditure. I mean, maybe you might, but for most people, you'd be pressing things. So you couldn't buy a refrigerator out of one period's income. You might accumulate the price of a refrigerator, but in order to do so, what would you have to be doing?
Save.
You'd have to save. And to buy a home, there has to be tremendous saving. Even if you'd get a loan, you will still most likely need a down payment. I think the standard down payment is 20%. So suppose here you are, you had $100,000 a year income, and you're being reasonably prudent, you'll only spend $300,000 for a home. Many people are doing a lot more than that, of course. But let's say you wanted to get a $300,000 house. Well, the 20% down payment is $60,000. How many people, even if they're earning $100,000 a year, can get that down payment together out of 1 year's income, let alone 1 month's income? So what must they do to get the down payment even? They have to save. And in order to borrow, where does the part of the proceeds that you borrow, where does that come from? That's other people's savings. So what is the demand for houses, automobiles, any expensive consumer's good, any consumer's good that represents more than a minor fraction of one pay period's income. It has to come from savings. The demand for all expensive consumers' goods depends on savings. Now, suppose people weren't saving. Well, how would anyone buy a house? They couldn't do it. If we didn't have saving, you couldn't have a demand for houses. You couldn't have a demand for automobiles. The demand for expensive consumers' goods rests on a foundation of saving.
That's right.
Now, this idea that when people are saving, this is bad for the economy, well, it's certainly not bad for the demand for expensive consumers' goods. That depends on saving. Now, let's go even further, and we'll see how the role of saving is even much more important than this. Consider all of the spending for capital goods, starting with all of the spending for goods at the wholesale level, and then all of the spending for machinery, equipment, materials, components, supplies, all the wage payments made by business firms. Are these payments made by the consumers when they buy the consumers' goods? No, they're made by the business firms. And what kind of expenditure do they represent?
Productive.
They're productive expenditures. These are expenditures made for the purpose of making subsequent sales at a profit. And this productive expenditure, this depends on saving. I jump ahead here. Productive expenditure depends on saving, on the portion of their revenues and incomes that people do not consume. Now just think, the extent to which business firms have funds available to buy goods at wholesale, to meet their payrolls, to buy materials, components, supplies, equipment, the rest of it, how is that affected by the extent to which they pay dividends?
How is it affected by
the extent to which a firm would pay a dividend? Let's say here you are, you have certain financial resources available to you. You have your sales revenues coming in. But you could, and firms do, use some part of their sales revenues to pay dividends. In the case of partnerships and sole proprietorships, the partner or proprietor draws funds from the firm. Every week he takes out a certain amount at his discretion. What is the effect of dividends and draw payments being increased or decreased on the funds available to make these productive expenditures? What are you saying?
Dividends will be decreased.
Well, I'm saying, what is the effect of paying greater dividends or making greater draw payments? What is the effect of that on the ability to make these productive expenditures?
It would increase.
It'll decrease it, right?
Right.
If you're paying greater dividends, what does that do to the funds you have available for the activities? It's less. So, and the purpose of the dividends, presumably, is consumption. In other words, the consumption that takes place out of the sales revenues, that is inversely related to the extent that the sales revenues can be used for productive expenditures. The sales revenues can be used to make either consumption expenditures via dividends and draw, or productive expenditures. To the extent that it be used for productive expenditures, the firms receiving the sales revenues have to abstain from consuming them. They have to save the sales revenues. The productive expenditure depends on saving, the abstention from consumption.
Yes.
So the demand for goods at wholesale, the demand for materials, equipment, supplies, etc., that depends on saving. Now, as a matter of fact, the great bulk of spending in the economic system is productive expenditure, not consumption expenditure. And I think we can illustrate this point by starting with the sales revenues of supermarkets. What is a typical profit margin in a supermarket?
5%, 2%,
15%.
I'm hearing bids ranging from 15 down to 2.
Whoa, I said low.
I think it's actually on the order of 2%. That's the profit margin, the net profit. Now, this does not mean that a supermarket could not have a 15% rate of profit, but the rate of profit is calculated on the capital invested, not the sales revenue. The profit margin is profit as a percentage of sales. Now, if you had a supermarket that earns 2% on sales, and if its sales were 7.5 times its capital, then 2% on something that's 7.5 times, that would be 15% on the capital. But on the sales, it's only 2% in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Well, now, if the profit margins of the supermarkets are on the order of 2%, what does that imply about their costs as a percentage of sales?
It's very high.
It would be 98%. The sales revenues equal cost plus profit. So if the profit is 2%, the costs are 98%. Now, what do the costs reflect? Where do the costs come from?
When labor, capital goods.
There's labor, capital goods, a lot of things reflected. But what in connection with labor and capital goods?
Expenditures.
Yes?
The money they put out to get them.
Expenditures.
Yeah, the prior productive expenditures. See, think about it. When a business has costs, the costs that a business deducts from its sales revenues derive from its prior expenditures. It's the expenditures that give rise to the costs. Now, how do you know what the labor cost is of producing a given product? So you just pull that number out of a hat? Or doesn't it come from the payment of the wages to the workers? That's what shows up as the labor cost. And where does your materials cost come from? It's the purchases of the materials. And the depreciation cost, that's the fraction of the purchase of the plant and equipment. So all of the costs reflect prior productive expenditures. They all reflect productive expenditures. And if costs are 98% of sales, what can we infer, at least approximately, as to the relationship between the sales and the productive expenditures that are made to earn those sales?
Productive expenditures must be high.
That they should be on the order of 98% too. But you have productive expenditures on the order of 98% of the sales, and that's giving you costs of 98% of sales. In fact, the productive expenditures can be a greater percentage. Let's say, imagine you have a firm, or even the supermarkets. Suppose the supermarkets are earning 2% on sales, but this 2% on sales is translating in to 10 or 15% on capital invested. What would the supermarkets be doing with some significant part of the profit that they're making? They'd be saving and reinvesting. So if the supermarkets were saving and reinvesting half of the net profit, what would that imply about the fraction of the sales revenues that was going into productive expenditure? I think that would imply that it's 99% instead of 98%. Because 2% is equal to the profit, and half of the profit is being saved and productively expended. So the productive expenditure in this case certainly is huge. And even if we take other cases, there are other industries where the profit margin is higher, maybe 10%. There are some where it's 20%. But even so, even if you have an industry with a relatively high profit margin, like 20%, well, what does the 80% represent?
Productive expenditure.
And if they're saving half their profit, then their productive expenditure could well be 90% of their sales. Now, if we look further, suppose we elaborate the supermarket example. Out of the 98 or 99, let's focus on the cost. 98% is cost. Some substantial part of those costs represents further sales revenues to other businesses, sales revenues to their suppliers. supermarkets are buying things to some extent from wholesalers. They're paying lighting and heating bills, advertising outlays. They purchased fixtures and equipment. All of these purchases are sales revenues to other firms. And these other firms, they have a profit margin too, and they have costs as a percentage of their sales. Well, suppose, for the sake of illustration, imagine that in the case of the supermarkets, of the 98 cents on each dollar of sales that's cost, assume 38 cents was labor cost and 60 cents was cost on account of purchases from other firms in one form or another. Goods at wholesale, lighting, heating, advertising, purchases of fixtures and structures, whatever. I now, how much more productive expenditure is there standing behind that 60 cents on the dollar that the supermarkets pay in buying capital goods? Suppose the suppliers to the supermarkets, suppose their profit margin is 10%, 10% of the 60 cents that they're getting from the supermarkets. Then what would be their costs?
54
cents, okay? Well now, even if we stopped here, how much productive expenditure have we counted up compared to the initial dollar of consumption expenditure? Yes?
$1.52.
We have 98 cents at least at the supermarket level, and then another 54 cents at the level of the suppliers to the supermarkets. And we could carry this to further stages, and it shouldn't be too surprising if we ended up with $2 of productive expenditure for every $1 of consumption.
Sure.
And I think in the economy as a whole, productive expenditure is probably at least as great as consumption expenditure, if not substantially greater. And the far greater part of that is simply ignored. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead a bit here and jump to point four, which is that saving increases real demand by increasing production. And here we'll try to make a link back to our discussion before the midterm of Say's Law. Say's Law establishes that real demand depends on production and supply. It's more production and supply that determine real demand. Well, one of the things that I'll be out to show, I suppose, next week is that the greater the degree of saving, the more rapidly can production and supply increase. The greater an economy's concentration on the production of capital goods, the greater will be its ability to produce. And if you want a quick shorthand confirmation, just think of Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and apparently China too.
Yeah.
They're concentrating on the production of capital goods and what's happening to their overall ability to produce each year.
It's growing.
It's rapidly growing. Now, what does that imply about real demand?
It's increasing.
That it's increasing correspondingly. So the greater the degree of saving, the higher and more rapidly growing will be aggregate real demand. Now, further, point five, if we had a commodity money, if we had a commodity money like gold or silver, and it's true that more saving serves to increase the ability to produce, so if we have more saving, we should be able to produce more automobiles, more television sets, whatever. If we have more and better mining equipment that saving makes possible, what does that imply about our ability to produce minerals? We should produce more minerals. And what does it imply about our ability to produce metals? And then still more specifically, the precious metals that constitute the money supply.
Positive correlation.
That we should be able to produce more of all of those things. So what should be happening to the quantity of money as a byproduct of the increase in the ability to produce under a precious metal monetary system. The quantity of money should grow, and what will that imply about the actual overall amount of spending in terms of money?
More money to spend.
That there'll be more money. So even though people are saving more heavily, the byproduct of this is a greater production of the monetary unit, which means, according to the quantity theory of money, a greater volume of spending. And ultimately, what would be the effect on the amount of spending even for consumers' goods? Pardon me?
Would increase.
It would increase. The spending for consumers' goods would be a smaller fraction, but it would be a smaller fraction of a larger total. Mm-hmm. The way you can think of it is, the more the economy saves, you can think of it in terms of a pie chart, the smaller the fraction of the pie that's consumption, and the bigger the fraction that is saving, the bigger and more rapidly growing does the whole pie tend to be. And as it gets to be big enough, the absolute size of the consumption slice, when it's a smaller fraction, it'll be a larger absolute amount. And I think very good. Yes, Mr. Taylor?
Well, I was going to ask, could you clarify how the increase of commodity money is realized because of savings?
We have greater saving. That will mean we have a greater concentration on the production of capital goods of all kinds.
Right.
Okay. And if there are more savings available, what will that do to the kinds of equipment available for things like gold mining?
Well, then I guess that would go up.
It would be improved.
Right.
Okay. And also, when you have a bigger supply of capital goods, the greater the supply of capital goods, the wider the range of technologies that can be adopted. And as we have the adoption of better technologies, that further contributes to the supply of capital goods. So we would expect that we have a general increase in production. One of the things whose production increases under a commodity money system should be the monetary unit also. So understood this way, more saving will underlie not only more real demand, but also more monetary demand. And a very good illustration of this, even without a gold standard, is Japan. Now, I assume you all know that from the 1950s, at least up till 1990, Japan was one of the most heavily saving economies in the world. And each year, this built up their ability to produce. Each year, out of whatever they could produce, they concentrated heavily on capital goods, which meant the next year they could produce more, and then they could produce more capital goods as well. And you do this for 40 years or so, and you have an incredible improvement. Well, how did Japan's tremendous growth as a producer, how did that affect the ability of the Japanese to consume?
Increased.
They became the world's second largest consuming nation after us. They were the world's second largest producing nation on the foundation of saving and capital accumulation, and this made it possible for them to consume vastly more than they had ever consumed before. Now imagine that the Japanese had not done what they did. Suppose they adopted the attitude they need to consume every last yen that they earn. What would have been the effect on the ability to develop the Japanese economy? Japan would be pretty much back where it was 50 years ago. And how would that have affected the ability of the Japanese to consume?
Couldn't consume as much.
They couldn't be consuming at the level of 50 years ago. Now, they would have consumed a higher percentage than they did at the time. Let's say in 1950, I don't know what precise percentage they consumed in that particular year, but out of their net income, let's say they consume 70%, they save 30% out of their net income. Well, had they not saved at all, they could have had some significant rise in consumption in 1950. They'd have been consuming 40% more than they did. But today, their whole economy has increased by a huge multiple. Maybe it's 10 times or more the size of what it was in 1950. And so if they consume 70% of something that's 10 times bigger, that's vastly more than 100% of where they were to begin with. So their ability to consume has depended on the high degree of their saving. And this is all under the heading of point six. Saving increases consumption in the long run by bringing about an increase in the production and supply of goods. Okay, now we're in a position to turn to aggregate economic accounting, and I describe it as aggregate economic accounting on an Aristotelian base, meaning a base recognizing that the demand for A is just the demand for A, that we don't buy any more than we're buying, and we have to take into account the separate, distinct purchases of capital goods and the payment of wages. And I want to develop aggregate economic accounting in the light of this approach. And where we will start is with the conventional accounting aggregates. The easiest accounting aggregate is national income, which is symbolized by the letter Y. This is the general convention. It's not my invention. And national income is the sum of four distinct components. There's profits, both corporate and individual and partnership. That's profits. And there's wages and salaries. There's net interest income. And then there's the further item, net rental income of persons. Now, this goes back to the terminology of the early classical economists. They distinguished three basic categories of income: profits, wages, and rent. They regarded interest as a kind of subcategory of profit, which we will do also. The way the national accounts are drawn up, there are these four basic components. And taking them all together, they equal national income. National income is simply the sum of all of the profit, interest, wage, and rental incomes of everybody in the economy. Domestic income, I guess today you'd call it domestic income, is the totality of the incomes of everybody living in the United States, everyone living and earning any kind of income in the United States. That would be what I'm calling national income. Now, a major aggregate accounting relationship is that national income is equal to net national product, NNP, or we could substitute net domestic product, NDP. There's only a very trivial difference between national and domestic. I may as well tell you the difference. The domestic product refers to what is produced or the incomes earned within the territory of the United States, whether it's earned by American nationals or by foreign nationals who are earning it here. A national product, in contrast, would exclude the earnings of foreign nationals within our borders and include the earnings of American nationals abroad. So the national product applies to the earnings of all nationals living here or abroad. The domestic product applies to earnings here, whether by nationals or by foreigners residing here. It doesn't amount to much difference. Pardon me?
Sums don't differ that much.
No, I would say it's an insignificant difference. We could disregard it. All right, but in any case, a central aggregate accounting relationship is that national income equals net national product, NNP, which in turn is equal to consumption plus net investment. And will include as a subcategory of consumption government spending.
There we go, right here.
This is a central relationship. National income equals net national product, or net domestic product, however you want to categorize it. We'd have to say, I suppose, domestic income equals net domestic product. But I'm more used to saying national income equals net national product, which in turn equals consumption plus net investment. Now, there's a very simple relationship between that and gross product. And let us take a look at that right away. Can you guys see this in the back?
I can't.
You can't? Would you like, there's an empty seat up here if you want to move forward. Let's see if I can enlarge it once more.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, now, here we are. We have the same relationship. Profit, wages, interest, and rent equals national income. Y equals net national product, which is, in turn, consumption plus net investment. Now, it's only a simple step to go from the NNP to GNP, or GDP. All you have to do is add depreciation allowances to NNP, that becomes GDP, or GNP. Add the same depreciation allowances to net investment, and we get gross investment.
Ah. Oh.
It can't be that thrilling. So, net investment, let me say a little more about what net investment is. Net investment is the sum of net investment in plant and equipment and net investment in inventory. There are two components to net investment in plant and net investment in inventory. If we add depreciation allowances to net investment in plant, it becomes gross investment. Let me elaborate on this a little more. The way net investment in plant would be arrived at is it's the difference between two things. It's the difference between the additions being made to plant and equipment by virtue of expenditures being made to buy them, and subtractions being made by virtue of depreciation. So let's imagine we have a firm. Let's make it very simple. Suppose you have a brand new firm, and it goes out and spends $1 million buying various pieces of equipment. Okay, what's the value of the equipment on its books? What it spent, $1 million, okay? So it opens its books with, it has $1 million worth of equipment that it's purchased. Now, let's suppose we go into the following year, and this equipment, let's say, has a life of 3 years, a depreciable life of 3 years. In fact, let's suppose they bought it all in the first quarter of the year, and so they'll have a year's depreciation in that first year, over a three-year life. Okay, they spent $1 million for their assets. Where would that enter in their balance sheet? Under what heading would that go? Well, it'd be the gross plant, right? The gross plant and equipment. Pardon me?
Plant and equipment.
Okay, that would be the gross plant and equipment again. And now let's assume they're depreciating it over a 3 year period. So what's their depreciation in this year?
333.
Okay, 333. Okay. What would be their net plant and equipment? 667. The million minus the 1/3 of $1 million. That's their net plant. Okay. Now, suppose in the next year, in year two, they buy a fresh $1 million of plant, a similar plant, and they'll do that in the first quarter, we'll imagine. And they incur 1/3 of it as depreciation. How much are they adding to their gross plant in the second year?
$1 million.
$1 million. They're adding $1 million to the gross plant. That's what they're buying. And what's depreciation in year two?
That year?
In year two.
Right, 666.
It's 666, because they have the depreciation on the new assets for a year, and the year two's depreciation on the assets they bought the year before. Okay, what's the effect on the on their net plant? How much has their net plant increased at the end of year two compared to year one?
12.2. Yeah, 666
twice.
Yeah. 1.3.
Okay, you say they have 1.3. Well, they have 2 million of gross assets, right?
Right.
Right.
Okay, and they have, what's the accumulated depreciation on the first year?
Six 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 on the first,
and 333 on the second. So what is their net plant? It's 1 million, 2 million minus 1 million.
Right.
The net plant is 1 million. And how much has their net plant increased this year compared with last year? It was 667, right? Now it's 1 million. It was 1 million minus 333. Now it's 2 million minus 1 million, right? Okay. So there's an increase in net plant of 333.
1.33.
Pardon me?
1.333.
No, it's 333.
Just
2 million minus 1 million. Okay. Now notice what's produced this 333 increase in net plant is the fact they've spent 1 million for new plant and equipment this year. But what is this year's depreciation? The depreciation that the firm will incur this year.
666.
Yes?
666.
It's 666666. They have 333 on the assets they bought this year and 333 from the assets last year. Well, notice the net change in their plant is the difference between their current expenditures on account of plant and equipment, the million, less their current year's depreciation. Now, how does this work? Well, the expenditures they're making in the current year for plant and equipment, that's an addition to gross plant. That's it, what's added to the gross plant account. If there were no current depreciation, the addition to gross plant would flow through as an equal addition to net plant. But we have a deduction from the gross plant. We have the depreciation. So to the extent there's depreciation, net plant is diminished. Purchases of gross plant add to the net plant, but depreciation subtracts from the net plant. New plant and equipment spending is an addition to net plant, but depreciation is a subtraction from net plant. Well, what is the difference between the sum of additions and the sum of subtractions? It's the net change, the net investment. The net investment is the difference between the sum we're adding to gross plant and implicitly net plant, and the sum we're subtracting from net plant, which is the depreciation. The expenditures for new plant and equipment are additions to gross plant and to net plant. The depreciation is a subtraction from net plant. So that's why it's net investment in plant. Now, if we don't subtract the depreciation, if we just look at the expenditures for new plant and equipment, well, that's the gross investment in plant. That's the gross investment. The net investment is that minus the depreciation. Yes?
Well, as a mere mortal, I'm trying to understand this.
Yeah.
And
you seem to understand it, yeah.
When you talk about the depreciation, you generally talk about on an annual basis for that 1 year, or you talk about an aggregate for the all the years up to that particular point?
Okay. When we talk about net investment, it's the current expenditure for new plant and equipment minus that year's depreciation, the current depreciation.
Current year depreciation.
Yeah. Right.
So if you've got prior depreciation from 3 years prior, we do not include that in that calculation.
That would not be included in a calculation of net or gross investment in the current year. That would be purely a balance sheet item. But when we take it into account, we see that enables us to see, I think, how it is that current expenditure for plant minus current depreciation, how that shows up as the net change in net plant. Okay, so GDP is essentially just consumption, private and government, and net investment. I'm sorry, gross investment. GDP is consumption, private and government, and gross investment. And NDP, or NNP, is GDP minus depreciation. Yes, Mr.
Blythe. So is it fair to say that net is before depreciation and gross is after depreciation?
No, it's the opposite. Net is after depreciation. Net is after, right? Yeah.
Okay. That's right.
When you say plus depreciation, does that generally mean subtracting depreciation? So you say you have $1,000 investment plus $500 in depreciation, does that mean that's $500 net value investment?
No. Whether we're adding or subtracting depends on the starting point. If our starting point is gross, then we subtract depreciation to get to net.
Right.
If we start with net, then we add depreciation to get to gross.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Whiteside.
Is it true that, generally speaking, I know that what you're talking about is that you say, oh, this piece of equipment that you buy has a life of 3 years.
Yeah.
Now, does the government decide how long you can depreciate it?
Well, they have something to say in terms of what they'll allow for tax purposes, so they have depreciation schedules, but you're not bound in your own accounting to go by their schedules. You could decide that obsolescence is extremely rapid, and you might, in your own accounting, depreciate more rapidly than is allowed for tax purposes.
Oh, I see.
Now, I don't know if you'd be able, if your auditors or accountants would let you have a published balance sheet or income statement in which you were depreciating less rapidly. They might have a problem with that.
There are some nationally accepted accounting practices.
Yeah, they're bound by the generally accepted accounting practices. Okay, so hopefully I've established what the aggregates are. The basic way to understand it, you all know what profit is. You know what a wage or a salary is. And the national income is the totality of all of that for everybody within the country for a year. And then GDP is essentially that plus the total of business depreciation allowances. Now, as I've shown, Keynesian economics obliterates the role of saving and productive expenditure. And in its view, almost all expenditure is consumption expenditure. The only other kind of expenditure it recognizes is net investment or sometimes gross investment. But the gross investment, bear in mind, gross investment is net investment with respect to inventories. I said there's two components of net investment. There's net investment in plant, and there's net investment in inventory. Gross investment is gross merely with respect to plant, not with respect to inventory. Not with respect to inventory. It's gross only with respect to plant. With respect to inventory, it's still net investment. Now, consumption spending, private and government together, is vastly larger than net investment. It's even vastly larger than gross investment. I think between the two of them, they're on the order of 85% of GDP, maybe even 90%. And because of this quantitative preponderance of consumption over anything else, it's usually assumed that consumption expenditure pays the great bulk of national income. See, we have this equation, profits, wages, interest, rent on the one side. That is equal to consumption plus investment on the other. And it's thought that consumption and investment pay the national income. That profits, wages, interest, and rent are paid by consumption plus investment. Well, consumption is vastly greater than investment, and so it's thought that the great bulk of incomes are paid by consumption. And this view of things is present implicitly or explicitly in every depiction of national income as being determined by the sum of consumption plus investment. And there is a popular diagram called the Keynesian cross, which you'll find in every contemporary textbook. And let us take a look at that. This thing, figure 15.2, is a Keynesian cross. And what we've got here is on the vertical axis, we have national income, consumption, and investment. And on the horizontal axis, we have simply national income. And here we have a 45-degree line. Every point on this line will represent equal distance on both axes. So this point here is the same on this axis as on this axis, and every other point on this line. Now, here's consumption. And if we only had consumption, the argument would be if this is the magnitude of consumption, this much consumption will generate this much income. Mm. This much consumption spending generates this much income. And if out of that level of income, people consume the same, if they would consume 100% of their incomes, then what would be the new income produced?
Equal.
It would be equal, it would be the same. And that's why this would be labeled an equilibrium point, E. This would be a kind of equilibrium. If this is income, and if out of this income an equal amount of consumption occurs, that will regenerate the same level of income. Okay, so here's consumption supposedly generating all of this income. Now let's add in investment. We'll assume some fixed amount of investment. Here's the magnitude of investment. It's the difference between this CC line and the C plus I line. This vertical distance is the amount of net investment. Okay, now how much income will the sum of consumption plus net investment generate? Let's say we started, we're over here, we have, let's say we have consumption generating this much income. How much more will be generated when we add in investment? If this is consumption and it's generating income equal to this, and this is consumption, the same amount of consumption plus a given amount of investment, how much income does it generate?
More.
Instead of generating from here over to here, it generates from here out to here. Now, here we are. If this were the level of income, let's say we're up here. Consumption plus investment are generating this much income at a certain point. Notice this is marked E prime. This indicates another higher equilibrium. How much consumption takes place out of an income equal to E prime?
Less E minus.
E minus this much here. And if we add to this much consumption, this much investment, how much is the total income generated?
That's fascinating.
It can't be that fast. I don't know why I feel like I'm being heckled.
Oh, it's me.
What's in the microphone?
For a specific amount or percentage? I mean, what are you looking for?
Okay.
Looking for more or less?
Pardon me?
Are you for a percentage? Are you looking for a difference?
Maybe I'm short-circuiting this a little bit. This line, CC... who here has taken a previous macroeconomics course? What would this represent? It has two parts to the name. The second part is function. You have the first letter of the first name. What? Yes?
Consumption.
The consumption function. This is a major doctrine in Keynesian economics. They claim that consumption expenditure is a mathematical function of income. And they have an equation of the form A plus CY. A is some constant, like $100 billion, and C is some fraction of the income, like 0.8 of income. So a possible consumption function would be $100 billion plus 80% of national income. And diagrammatically, if that would mean here's $100 billion,
right.
This much consumption occurs if there's zero income. But then as income rises, if income gets above zero, well, now we have to add to the 100 billion, 80% of whatever the income is. Well, here we are, we have 100 billion plus 80% of the income, that reproduces the income.
Is that national income that you're talking
about? Yeah, this would be national income. Imagine if national income were 500 billion and consumption is 100 billion plus 0.8 of national income, how much would consumption be?
1.4 billion.
What's 100 plus 0.8 of 500? 100 plus 0.8 of 500 is 400. So it would be 500. If this consumption function were 100 billion plus 0.8, well, and if this is 500 billion of income, we'll have 500 billion of consumption, and that will regenerate the same income. But now, suppose we have some given amount of investment, like $20 billion of investment.
Right.
Okay, now, then the equilibrium income is going to be substantially higher. The equilibrium income is going to be, I would think, $600 billion, according to the Keynesians. If we have $600 billion income, how much consumption will $600 billion generate?
$600.
If consumption is equal to 100 plus 0.8 of the income. What's 100 plus 0.8 of 600? 580, I think. 100 plus 60%, 80% of 600, that's 480 plus 100, that's 580. Okay, here we are, this would represent 580 of consumption. Now, if this were the only factor at work, all it would produce would be an income over here, an equal income, 580. This wouldn't be an equilibrium. But what makes it an equilibrium is that there's $20 billion of net investment. So between 580 of consumption and 20 of net investment, now we have a $600 billion income equilibrium. Okay, but without overdoing this, out of this $600 billion equilibrium income, how much appears to be paid by consumption and how much by investment?
580.
It appears consumption is paying 580 and investment 20. That's how the Keynesians see it. They see consumption as paying the overwhelming bulk of the incomes in the economy. And that's what's indicated by any such diagram as this. They think consumption is the really big gun and investment accounts for the remaining smidgen. It has an alleged multiplier effect, but the overwhelming bulk of incomes is supposedly paid by consumption.
Here comes the reasoning cross.
When was that Keynesian era? When was Keynes
around? Well, Keynes himself died in 1946, and his major book was published in 1936 or 37. But his influence continues very powerfully down to the present day.
What was his major publication?
His major book is called The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And a major disciple of his is Paul Samuelson, who's now very old. But his textbook, I think, is in its 18th edition or something. For many decades, it was the leading textbook of the country. We have now a number of other prominent textbooks. But pretty much all of them have the same basic contents. And I think you'll find a Keynesian cross in just about every textbook, an assumption that national income is paid by the sum of consumption plus investment, and consumption is far and away the major item. Yes, Mr. Davis.
Should we expect to be tested on that particular component?
Well, let's get to it. We'll see it in a little more detail, then we can answer the question better.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a question here, something very similar to which will appear on the final, and you'll be asked to identify how much of income is paid by consumption, how much is paid by productive expenditure. But we have to develop the framework a little more.
Yeah, we might want to develop that a little bit.
Okay. Now, what I want to do is present what I think is an accurate conception, one which recognizes the role of productive expenditure. What I'm going to attempt to show is that while it is true that national income does equal consumption plus net investment, and consumption is in fact vastly larger than net investment, we could even have conditions in which net investment showed up as zero. That would be possible. I'm still going to show that the great bulk of spending in the economic system is productive expenditure, and the productive expenditure is concealed under the head of net investment. I'm going to try to show that net investment in its relationship to total spending in the economy is like the visible portion of an iceberg is to its overall volume. You know, the visible part of an iceberg in the ocean, I think, is on the order of 1/10 of the volume of the iceberg. Most of it is underwater. Well, similarly, most of the spending that goes on under the head of net investment is also underwater in the following sense. One of the things I will show is that net investment is the difference between two huge magnitudes. One is total productive expenditure in the economy, where most of the spending is counted, and the other part is the total costs that are deducted from sales revenues in calculating profits. I'll be out to show along the way that net investment is equal to productive expenditure minus costs. And you could conceivably have productive expenditure and costs equal. They'll never be hugely different. And if they were equal, net investment would be zero, but still the great bulk of spending in the economy would be under the head of net investment. Now, what I want to do is go into a step-by-step derivation of the equality between profits and wages on the one side and consumption plus net investment on the other, and show how it conforms to this, how it illustrates this. Now, incidentally, along the way, to reduce the number of terms we're working with, I've compressed the four components, profit, wages, interest, and rent, into just two, profits and wages. Let me justify that for a moment. We can put interest together with profits. All we have to do essentially is take profit as pre-deduction of interest cost. We'll take profit as gross of interest. The same thing you would do if you were calculating the magnitude of return earned in a firm. If you wanted to calculate the rate of return on capital, you'd have to add the profits and interest together. Well, we'll do that, and we'll just work with a profit concept that's gross of the interest. Now then, there's this remaining item, rent. For the most part, rent is a fiction, as it's portrayed in the accounts. I think I pointed out last week that the biggest part of the component, net rental income of persons, is an imputation. It's an allowance for an alleged net rental value of owner-occupied housing, where there is no rental. You're in the house, you're in your own house, you're not paying rent, you're not getting rent, but they go into the complicated procedure to try to create this imputation for rent. I think we discussed this adequately last week. So to that extent, the whole component is a fiction. There is some legitimate part of net rental income. There are certain net rental incomes, but to the extent that there are, we'll add them to profits too. If you're truly making an income on a rental, well, how does that differ from a profit? So we'll count that with profit. So we have just two basic components, profits plus wages, that's national income, and we're going to show step by step how this equals consumption plus net investment. Now, we do this in a series of simple equations. Mr. Rosendahl, are you able to see this? Okay, we start off with equation one. By definition, the sum of profits and wages equals national income. No, I don't think anyone will have a quarrel with that. That's just true by definition. In equation two, instead of continuing with profits, we substitute for profits sales minus costs. Does anyone have a problem with that? I mean, what is a profit in the case of any individual firm? It's the sales minus cost. Well, we're talking about total aggregate profit in the whole economy, so if we want to express it in terms of sales minus cost, we need to add up all the sales revenues of all the firms in the whole economy and subtract the totality of all the income statement costs. That will be aggregate profit. Now, I use the letter D instead of C because C is associated with consumption. So we're using D for deduction. S minus D is profit. Now, in equation three, all we do is substitute equation two into equation one. We have national income is now equal to sales minus costs plus wages. Aggregate sales minus aggregate costs plus wages. That's
Would wages go under
costs? Well, now wages are a component of costs, but there are timing differences, and we're looking at wages in a double perspective.
So the income rather than expense view.
a wage earner's income is the wages he's paid, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there's certainly a connection between the wages paid and the cost deducted, right? And even if the wages paid were deducted simultaneously, if we're looking at total incomes, profits and wages together, we'd have to look at sales minus costs for profits and add wages to get profits and wages together.
So they've already been deducted.
Well, you deduct wages from sales to get profits, but you have to add wages to get the sum of profits and wages. To this extent, wages enter positively and negatively. But in reality, the wages that are paid and the appearance of wages as cost, they're related, but they are typically not identical. Because just think, suppose you're paying wages to workers to construct a building. Okay, those workers are getting their wages now, right? When will their wages show up as a cost?
When they're paid.
Well, when will it show up as a deduction from sales revenues in an income statement?
A month later.
Pardon me?
End of the year.
Another period.
Well, no.
In the period the revenue is recognized.
And when will the revenue be recognized? You're having a building constructed.
When you get paid.
How many years does the building stay in service, and over how many years will revenue be associated with the cost of the building? Over the depreciable life of the building. So let's say, here we are, we've paid $1 million in wages as part of the cost of constructing a building, and this building will last 40 years. How will we depreciate the building? Well, presumably 2.5% a year. So it'll be $25,000 a year for 40 years. That's when the wages are showing up as part of the cost. So the wages in this case are showing up as a cost over the next 40 years. Now, it's not often that extreme, but suppose we're looking at a manufacturing concern. General Motors is paying wages in October, November, and December. And much of these wages are being paid to produce cars which General Motors and its dealers may not sell until January and February. And when will the wages being paid in October, November, and December show up as part of General Motors' cost of goods sold? Well, when those cars are sold, not when they're produced, when they're sold. So there are important timing differences. Now, there are some wages which are deducted as cost immediately. That might be the wages perhaps of executives, I don't know, depending on the accounting treatment. There's selling, general, and administrative expenses. And I think the usual procedure is not to capitalize these outlays, but to deduct them immediately as a cost. Well, to that extent, you'd have wages showing up both as a cost right away and as being added to the sales revenues.
Maybe we should call that labor rather than wages.
Well, the monetary amount is wages. You see, the labor would mean the number of hours of work of a given kind, but we have to bring in the monetary totals. So here we are. We start off, national income is profit plus wages. No, is there a problem with that?
No.
Okay. Is there a problem with profits or sales minus costs? Is there a problem that profits plus wages equal sales minus costs plus wages? We've got it simply by substitution. Now, what I want to do as the next step is we want to look at the sales revenues, and we want to look at the sales revenues from the perspective of the customers and from the perspective of their purpose in making their purchases. And from that point of view, we can take every dollar of sales revenue and regard it from the point of view of the buyer as either a productive expenditure or a consumption expenditure. Let's deal with the sales revenues of General Motors and its dealers. To the extent that people are buying General Motors cars for the purpose of their own personal transportation, not for business purposes, what kind of expenditure is that?
Consumption.
A consumption expenditure. Now, we would categorize that as S sub C. Now, the S is for sales revenue. The sub C is that when you view it from the perspective of the customer, it's a consumption expenditure. So S sub C is that part of business sales revenues which are coming from consumption expenditures. S sub B is that part of business sales revenues which from the point of view of the customer is a productive expenditure. So let's say National Car Rental buys thousands of cars from General Motors. Why are they buying General Motors cars?
Business.
For business purposes. So what kind of expenditure is that?
Productive.
It's a productive expenditure. There are also corporations buying General Motors cars for business purposes. That's productive expenditure. General Motors has a heavy truck division, I believe. That would almost entirely be productive expenditures. Its diesel locomotive division would be largely productive expenditures to the extent that freight railroads are buying them. Looking at things from the point of view of the customers, every dollar of sales revenue is either a productive expenditure or a consumption expenditure. All of those sales revenues that are consumption expenditures from the perspective of the customers, we call S sub C. All of those which from the perspective of the customers are productive expenditures, we call S sub B. Is there any dollar of sales revenues that won't fit into one or the other category?
No.
No, I wouldn't think so. And we do exactly the same thing with wages. This is from the perspective of the employer. All of the wages paid by business firms are wage payments that, from the point of view of the employer, are productive expenditures. So we call them W sub B. There are other wages that are paid, the most important being the government's payroll, and then there are some maids employed by housewives and so forth, butlers and secretaries employed by very wealthy people. This would be wages that from the point of view of the employer is consumption expenditure, W sub C. Now, I've used the subscript B because P is taken up by profit. So think of B as business. B is business. That's productive expenditure. Now, I call these SB, SC, WB, WC, I call them revenue hyphen expenditure subcomponents. They're revenue when looked at from the point of view of the seller. They're expenditure when looked at from the point of view of the buyer. Now, all that we do in equation six, all we've done is substitute 4 and 5 into 3. Here's 3, S minus D plus W, that's national income. We've broken S and W down into these two revenue expenditure subcomponents, and in equation 6, we substitute them. And so now we have that part of sales revenues, which is consumption expenditure, plus that part of sales revenues, which is productive expenditure, minus costs, plus that part of wages, which is consumption expenditure, plus that part of wages, which is productive expenditure. All of this taken together, what's it equal? It's still national income. We just have an elaboration. Now the next step is what we want to do is change the order of addition of these components. Up to now, we've been adding them in order of their revenue type. We've had S sub C and SB minus D. We've had WC and WB. We're looking at things from the perspective of profits and wages. Now we want to change the order of addition to accord with the kind of expenditures that are present. So we're going to group the S sub C and the W sub C together, one after the other, and the SB and the WB together, one after the other, and move costs to the end. Is there any problem with doing this?
No.
Well, all we have to do next is realize that the two sub C components add up to total consumption. The two sub B components add up to total productive expenditure. And now what we have, when we substitute 8 and 9 into 7, we have C plus B minus D is equal to Y. A consumption expenditure plus productive expenditure minus cost, that's equal to national income. And then the last thing to realize, which I'll have to wait to demonstrate next week, is that productive expenditure minus cost is net investment.
Repeat that last one.
Productive expenditure, B representing total productive expenditure, minus costs, that's net investment.
That's I.
Here it is. B minus D is I. And then if that's true, all we do is we substitute I for B minus D, and we have C plus I is Y. We've derived it. It's true. But, pardon me?
Oh, it's rudimentary.
I'm sorry?
Rudimentary.
But if you grasp it, it is rudimentary. It's not that difficult. But having looked at it this way, we're in a position to see that most of the actual spending in the economy is under the heading of I. It's I is B minus D. B is huge. That's where most of the spending is.
Oh, really?
Net investment?
It's productive expenditure is most of the spending. Net investment is productive expenditure minus cost. That's to be demonstrated first thing next week.